So I think this is the sixth class. Last time at the end of the class, I didn't pass this out to everybody, so maybe I'll go ahead and pass it around again. There's two sheets already collated with the quiz and the quiz answer. And if you're missing, this is for quiz four. If you're missing anything prior to this, just see me during the break or after class. And yeah, both of those sheets, yeah. And I'll be happy to get that to you during the break or after. So last time we started this rather more difficult section. Not that this is the whole chapter is rather difficult, but this is a particularly difficult section because we're working with the refutation specifically of some of the views of the Chittamatrans, the mind-only school. So those of you, again, who took the tenets class or are familiar with Chittamatra already know that there's some fundamental things that Chittamatra holds that we, in the Prasangika Madhyamika school, feel we need to contradict. We need to, you know, negate these views because these are erroneous views. The two main ones have to do with this illusion that Chittamatra says is going on. So we say there's an illusion too. Their illusion is that things have an existence that's external to the mind, that in the sense that external objects having a being different than the subject that perceives them, being of a different substance than the mind that is realizing that object. So what Chittamatra says is that there is an imprint that ripens into this dual experience of subject and object, but there's an ignorance that mistakenly holds that external object to be external, to be of a different substance than the mind. So this is their illusion, and this is one thing that, you know, leads to two problems, the two main problems that Prasangika objects to. One is the denial of external objects existing as external. Prasangika says there's no problem with things being external to the mind. In fact, this is a valid cognition of things being external to the mind. You know, so this paperclip is not arising from the same substance as my mind, as Chittamatra holds. It actually is an external object and can be posited as an external object. It just doesn't exist inherently. But the other side of it is that because of the reification of the mind, Chittamatra also holds the mind to be inherently existent quite strongly. They would also hold there being some inherent existence to these external objects as well, which is a bit of a problem too. But because of their strong reification of the mind, this is another area where, you know, Madhyamika takes great exception to the views of Chittamatra. So what we were doing is, last time, is we started off with a few of the verses that deal with refuting some of these views, and we ended up in a discussion about self-cognition, self-cognizers, or it's called in some texts autocognition, basically meaning that there is some other aspect of consciousness that can be uniquely identified that is inwardly oriented. It's, you know, their rationale for this mind is that when we have a recollection, I was using the example last time of, like, you know, you went to the opera. When someone asks you about your experience at the opera, you can remember the objects you saw. And you can remember the costumes and the singing and, you know, all these various things that occurred. But you also have a recollection of the subjective experience of that. So they can say, you know, well, you know, what did you see? And you can tell them, but you can also, they can also ask you, you know, and did you enjoy it, and what was going on? You know, were you feeling good that evening, or what have you? You have a whole subjective experience that is a part and parcel of the entire experience. According to Chittamatra, in order to have that experience validated and recalled, we need to have some aspect of the mind that's inwardly oriented, that it's like the self-cognizer knows the consciousness, so that the consciousness knows the object, but we wouldn't know the consciousness unless the self-cognizer was knowing the consciousness. So we can know the object through the force of the consciousness that's directly knowing it, but in order to know the consciousness, it requires that other level of consciousness. So Prasangika holds, you know, has great objections to this and feels that this is an unnecessary thing. There's probably some deeper, you know, things again involved in the realization of that. I looked into, there's a text called The Unique Tenets of the Middleway Consequence School. It's a rather large tome. It's got all these things that are uniquely held by the Consequence School, Prasangika School. And one of their views, of course, you know, is the refutation of a self-cognizer, of self-cognition. And in there, it didn't really give a lot of other, you know, rationale for doing this other than simply not wanting that to be a valid tenant, that they really don't feel that there's any valid justification for that existence of that. It does get caught up in some of this idea of inherent consciousness, inherently existent consciousness, but again, I think that for now we don't really need to spend a lot of other time on that. So that what we were going through last time specifically were some examples that Chittamatra uses to justify there being self-cognition. Does anyone recall there were two examples first that they used that had to do with kind of how they set out that self-cognizers exist in the same way that... Right. Okay, so they say that a butter lamp not only illuminates the things around the butter lamp, it also illuminates itself. So in the same way, consciousness can know outside objects, but also consciousness can know consciousness. And this was refuted by Madhyamika. Anyone recall the refutation? There were a few points.
Light can't do light.
Yeah. Light doesn't need to be lit. You know, if light needed to be lit, it would be obscured by darkness, and then anything could be obscured by darkness, you know, so darkness would be obscured by darkness. And so there's a lot of consequences from holding this example to be somewhat an example we could rely upon. Then what was the second example that they used?
Clear glass on the table.
Okay. So they said that there's a difference between when we put a clear or, you know, crystal glass on a very deep blue tablecloth, it seems to be blue itself, kind of picks up the color of the blue because of its clarity. And so it reflects the blue, seems to be blue, but is not blue on its own. They say this is similar to the consciousness that is, you know, knowing the object. On the other hand, there is something like a piece of lapis lazuli, you know, nice blue rock that has in and of itself its own nature of blue. So it's sort of, you know, blue that's not arising due to the force of something else. It's arising within itself. So this is, again, this idea of consciousness, knowing consciousness within itself, not requiring anything outside of it. So it's a really strange little argument. I thought about it some, and I'm still not really clear about all the aspects of it, but how was that refuted? Yeah, Janice.
Even lapis depends upon causes and conditions for its formation of blue.
Right. So it's not really a valid reason, again, because what they're saying is kind of something that is almost, again, from a mind-only point of view, inherently blue, that has its own inherent blueness, which is something that the Prasangikas aren't going to adhere to in any situation. They don't subscribe to the same rationale that the lower schools would in terms of once they start adhering to something being inherently blue, then we have a problem. So there is no blue that arises from its own blueness. Blue, there is no inherently existent blueness. The blue of the lapis arises from causes and conditions in the same way that the blue of the crystal arises, and you know, from being close to the cloth. They're different types of causes, but they are definitely still in the nature of being causes and conditions that blue is dependent upon. So there was then a little bit more, you know, kind of discussion of this topic, and we ended up with looking at how Prasangika then sets out how memory exists, because this was the main point, was that Chittamatra was saying, well, you can't have memory of the consciousness knowing that object without a self-cognizer. So we went into this little example that they use, which was the poison of a rat, that this sort of poisonous rat that bites a hibernating bear in winter, and when the bear wakes up in spring when the thunder comes and, you know, comes out of hibernation, through the pain of the poison being in his system, kind of discerns that this must have occurred. And it's a really strange little thing. What's interesting is I was looking at one of the texts that we have, and it says even Kedrup Jay, who was one of Lama Tsongkhapa's two main disciples, found this analogy very, very peculiar and didn't really get it, you know. I'm not really sure that and what's really interesting is if you go to like several different texts, you get a very different explanation in some of them that, you know, versus what we have in our commentary. Maybe we'll just real quickly go through that explanation. If you turn to page 228, I think. Yeah. So this is just a little ways down where it says middle way proponent. Drukpa Gelson's commentary says, remembering the object possessor does not establish the self-cognizer. So his point is that Chittamatra is saying that because we remember the object possessor, the consciousness at the time of knowing something, doesn't establish the existence of a self-cognizer. So for example, when the apprehender of blue experiences another object blue, so let's say my eye consciousness seeing blue, the remembrance of the object possessor will be generated in relation, that is, from the relationship between the object and the object possessor. I previously saw this blue. So the idea here is that there is an interdependence going on. When my eye consciousness is seeing blue, merely by remembering the blue, recalling blue, I can recall the consciousness that knew blue at that time. So there is no need for another level of consciousness because the mere interdependent relationship between subject and object, they mutually establish each other. Which again is also getting at their lack of any inherent existence because we never have an inherently existent object with inherently existent subject. They never have any sort of concrete independent existence. They're always arising in dependence upon each other. So something is only an object in regard to a subject perceiving it. Something is only a subject in regard to perceiving an object. Yeah, this is another point that gets raised, you know. I think there's lots of ramifications from adhering to inherent existence, consequences of adhering to inherent existence that are, when we see them, they might sound kind of strange because we don't find that that's a consequence for us in our ignorance. But if we really examined what it was that we were believing in through our ignorance, we would find that those consequences are there. You know, things can't function if they're inherently existent. Things can't, you know, arise. They would be stuck in some mode of existence all the time, would never, you know, change, would never, you know, in any way arise in a different way. So there's lots of consequences that we'll see throughout this. But in this commentary, and this was in Shantideva's verse, he says, you know, it's like the poison of a rat not being experienced at the time of lethargy, you know, meaning while the bear was hibernating, but remembered subsequently. For example, during winter, although the rat injected the rat poison into the... It's not really rat poison. It's poison. Rat poison means what you kill a rat with. But anyway, he injected the poison into the body of the bear when in lethargy. The lethargy is experienced, but not the poison. So the idea here is, this is just an analogy, and as best as I can make it out, this is what's going on. So you have this experience during sleep. So the bear's mind is totally set on lethargy, on sleep. This is the object that the bear is knowing. At the same time of that, there is a cognition of the object, which in this case is exemplified by the injection of the poison into the bear. So it's only later, through the force of recalling, I was hibernating, you know, then this must have occurred, the injection of poison must have occurred, that there is a recollection of the subject on the basis of the object. It's a very strange one, again, because in the example, it's almost like the bear makes the sort of assumption or implication that there was a bite during winter on the basis of the pain that he experiences after waking. But in here, it's like it's just an analogy. And so what they're trying to show is that there are two things going on at the same time, a subjective experience and an objective side to it. You know, so an object that's being experienced and a subject that's experiencing it. This is occurring at the same time, in the same way that the injection of poison from the rat bite is happening at the same time that the bear is sleeping. And that's almost as far as you can kind of take the analogy, I think, to some degree. So if we look at what's explained here in terms of these pieces of it, the injection of the poison occurring simultaneously with the lethargy is analogous to the experience of the object possessor existing simultaneous with the apprehended object. So when my eye consciousness is knowing blue, it's like the injection of poison and the lethargy. These are both occurring at the same time. But my mind is usually focused solely on the object, in the same way that the bear is solely involved in sleep and is not really realizing that the injection of poison is occurring. Point two, that next one. The object possessor not being experienced by itself at that time is analogous to the poison not being experienced at the time of the lethargy. So that's what I just, you know, said, is that there's this, we're mostly caught up in the object. So we're only, you know, we're at the opera, seeing the opera, totally caught up in the sights and sounds and, you know, event of the opera. Three, remembering the lethargy subsequently is analogous to remembering the experience of the object. So we can say that the bear recalls having been asleep, I mean, or having been under the spell of sleep. We also have a recollection of the object. Again, that's just the analogy. That's as far as you can take it. Don't take it too much further in terms of what's going on in the bear's mind and all the other things. We're really just talking about these two being something that is an object and an object possessor that are remembered in. Even though they occur at the same time, one might not be known at that time, but they both are remembered by recalling each other. The fourth point, remembering the previous object possessor, meaning the object possessor at the time of knowing that object, although it did not experience itself, meaning although it doesn't have some self-cognizer happening at that time, through the very remembrance of the experience of the object, which is how Prasangika holds that memory occurs. We recall the object possessor merely by, you know, remembering the experience of the object. That's analogous to remembering the previously injected poison that was not experienced at that time through the very remembrance of the lethargy. So again, this is as far as we can really take this analogy, I think, is they're just saying there are two things going on at the same time. In the example of the poison being injected, injection of the poison is like the object possessor, because we're usually not focused on the object possessor, we're focused on the experience of the object, you know, just as the bear is caught up in the lethargy. That lethargy can be recalled in the same way we can recall an object. But we can also recall the injection of the injection of the poison can also be recalled because it's occurring in relation to that lethargy at the same time as that lethargy. Again, it's really weird in the example. We just have to see it in terms of the point of object possessor and object and how we're knowing those and how we're relating to those. Do you all have time to sort of read up a bit on this and think about it? Any questions about it?
I'm just trying to compare it to when I was bitten on the foot.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Well, or it was raining, set in rain.
Uh-huh.
And paid a little attention to it.
Right.
Until late the next day, mm-hmm. when I seemed to come down a little bit and case of blood poisoning.
Yeah.
Because I've gone to town care of a sick child and all this stuff. And we had to go back and try and figure out what had happened, why I had this red line up my leg. It was just like, and it was really only by comparison that this could only be what had happened. Mm-hmm. But I cannot, I remember something feeling like it bit my foot. Right. I paid really no attention. I was running, uh-huh. It was raining in my head. And so,
yeah.
I'm trying to say, you know, you really remember things in relation to other things. Is that what it's saying?
Well, but it's really just saying that you remember the object possessor, the subjective experience of that, through the force of remembering the object you were knowing at that time. Again, I wouldn't take it too far in terms of what's going on with the bear. In the bear's mind of recalling the injection of poison on the basis of the lethargy. I don't think that that's really what we're talking about. Yeah. What? Let's leave the analogy behind, and we simply say that Prasangika is holding that the memory occurs solely through the force of recalling the object you recall the object possessor. So if I asked you, for example, recall your graduation from college or high school or whatever that day, you know, and what the subjective experience of being there you recall through the force of merely remembering the object of the hall and the people there and the cap and gown and the whatever was going on, the diploma, all the other things that were a part of that objective experience, things that you were experiencing at that time, that you can then recall the subjective experience of having been there and having experienced your graduation and the joy of graduation and all the other things that go with it. So there's no need for another level of consciousness to be there to kind of be examining it at the moment. put it into place, because we recall simply by recalling, we recall the objective or the subjective experience merely by the force of recalling the object that we experience.
But Sidney wants you to say there's a another mind function.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Charmaine, did you get any better about, I mean, do you feel like you still want to hold to the self-cognizer? Or? But you still think there's
a... I think I see where they, why they want to have that.
Yeah.
I think the instinctual experience is that we feel like something is watching, and we feel like it's other or external.
Yeah.
I think I have some sense of like feeling the self-confidence in me. But it doesn't really...
Right.
I feel like that's like sort of a need to put on the experience where it's like to walk through my day.
Okay. I mean, I think there's certainly some form of self-awareness that's always there. I mean, the fact that we are, that's what consciousness is consciousness is knowing, and consciousness is that experiential side of it. So, you know, I don't know, I think where we're taking some issue is what Chittamatra is defining as self-cognition, which is quite precise and very specific. You know, it's an inwardly oriented consciousness that is able to take consciousness as its own object at the same time that it is a subject. We can take consciousness as an object through introspection and other factors, but there's a big, big difference in terms of how this is functioning.
If your mind is just moving back and forth across the sort of data that you recognize about a given situation, that's not necessarily a separate function of the mind. It's just the way the mind moves.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the point. Ajna, did you have a...
Yeah, no, I just kind of trying to make sense of it. So, Chittamatra would say that memory is more of an objective experience, whereas I don't have the same memory.
No, I think Chittamatra is saying that there are two aspects to memory of an experience. We can talk about the objective memory, the experience of the object, and we can talk about the experience of the object possessor. And they can both be recalled, but in order to recall the object, we need the consciousness that was knowing the object to validate it and to, you know, sort of imprint it in the mind, if you will, so that we can recall it. And then we need the self-cognizer in order to recall the object possessor that was knowing that object. And again, another one of the consequences that gets thrown out by, you know, Prasangika is that then you need another level of consciousness to validate the self-cognizer that is validating that, or else you can't validate that. And I mean, you end up with this infinite regress of consciousnesses that are needed in order to validate each of the individual consciousnesses that are validating another consciousness. So, you know, we do run into a lot of these sorts of problems with it as well. Prasangika simply holds that there's this really strong interdependence of subject and object, you know, and those two validate each other. We validly cognize an object, but that object, through the force of remembering it, allows us to recall the consciousness that knew that object. You know, so we can equally, you know, recall both of them, but only in relation to each other, not in relation to there being some other consciousness involved in validating it. It's a strange concept, but again, I think at some level, like Charmaine says, we do kind of have some sort of experiential thing going on of thinking that there is that awareness there or something.
And you feel separate, the subject from the object, you know. I think, you know, and it's only through investigation that maybe it's more interesting, and that when you get something real, that you realize that this instinctual feeling isn't actually that.
But again, we're talking about a consciousness that's even separate to some from that subject, rather than, yeah. I mean, not that they're both kind of the same entity, but it's completely distinct within
and
that.
And that feeling of separation, I think, makes me think that that's where Chittamatra came up with the idea that there's a separate self consciousness that's watching.
Yeah.
This feeling of separateness.
Yeah.
So when I first heard it, for me, it wasn't like it was so way after.
Okay. I understand. Yeah. But I think, again, you know, there's certainly a lot of room to explore these concepts and to sort of find out what our own point of view is and examine these in meditation and what have you. But So any more questions on just this, what we've gone through so far? I want to kind of start to move into some new material. See if we can at least finish this section on mind only. So where we're at then, we went through then that last little paragraph that comes, it says, this appears to be a marvelous reasoning and so on. This is just kind of a reiteration of that this is how memory occurs within Prasangika, and specifically memory of the object possessor, and that self-cognizers, some idea that self-cognizers are not refuted conventionally is really not what Shantideva is trying to say here at all. He's definitely refuting their existence conventionally. You know, don't mistake it. He doesn't find that there's any ground to stand on to assert the existence of self-cognizers. So now we move on into another refutation, this one involving an alternative reasoning that would prove self-cognizers. So this entails verse 24ab, and then the reply comes shortly after. So let's go back to page 226 and read actually both the assertion and the reply, all of verse 24. Because those possessing other conditions see it, it is clear to itself. Through applying the eye medicine of attainment, bases are seen, but the eye medicine is not. So, as you'll see in the commentary, this person is now, the mind-only person is now saying, well, you know, let me give you another way that this can be exemplified. And what they use is this idea of those who have developed a clairvoyance. Now, in not just Buddhist schools, but also in Hindu meditation, it's said that when you attain various levels of concentrations, that you do attain certain clairvoyances, that these clairvoyances are powers that come with developing meditative concentration. And so you can actually know others' minds, you know, and you direct your mind towards them, and you can, you know what's going on in other people's minds. So what they're saying here is because there are others, there are people, those who possess these conditions, such as having trained and, you know, pervasiveness through the practice of calm abiding, which is the fundamental level of concentration that we need. There are concentrations that are built on top of that. They see the mind, meaning, you know, they see others' minds. So then one's own mind, which is very near, whereas others' minds, which are very far, would also appear. Because, you know, just as we can see, if we can see a faraway needle, we can also see a nearby mountain. So if somebody had really good vision, there's like 20/10 vision, isn't there? Like people who are even better than 20/20. You know, if they could see like somebody holding up a needle at a far distance and there was a mountain between you and that person, well, you'd certainly see the mountain, which is much bigger and much closer, if you could see the faraway needle. So in the same way, if you can see other people's minds through developing a clairvoyance, so you could direct them, you know, your attention towards somebody's mind abiding distance from you, you would also be able to then see your own mind. So there must be some aspect of mind that can know mind. Sounds like a reasonable, you know, argument. Middle way proponent says, well, let's use another example that shows that, you know, this doesn't necessarily hold, this pervasion that you're trying to set out in regard to why you could have mind knowing your own mind. Through applying the eye medicine, where the eye medicine, a substance of attainment, is anointed on the eye. So in that time, I guess there were various ointments they could put on the eye directly, and that would allow you to have some sort of clairvoyant ability to be able to see treasure buried under the ground and what have you. Again, it's interesting, one of the commentaries talks about how Shantideva talks about these things like they're everyday things that we all deal with, you know. You know, did you have your eye ointment today, April? You know, did you find any treasure on, you know? I mean, this isn't, you know, something we normally have much experience with, but maybe in Shantideva's time these things were quite common. He says, you know, they were able, through that eye ointment, to be able to see treasures such as vases under the ground. But the eye medicine itself is not seen. What's interesting is in His Holiness's commentary, those of you who've been reading that, you know, the practicing wisdom, he actually says the eye is not seen, not the eye medicine, which is a big difference. I think that the point here, I'm not saying His Holiness is wrong, I'm just saying I think that there's maybe some problem with the editing of this, because it really makes much more sense when we talk about it being looking at the eye medicine not being seen by the eye, although it can see treasure under the ground, because the eye medicine's very close or near to the eye, but it can't be seen by the eye. In the same way, we can't say that by this analogy that mind-only is setting out, that something that is near can be seen if we can see something far. This is not a, there's no pervasion to that argument. This is actually, I think, on page, let me go to my other notes here, on page 53 of your book, if you want to go back and look at it. Because he says there, yeah, similarly they argue just because a mind can perceive its other's mind, oh no, I'm sorry, earlier, does not provide that the person's eye with the power to perceive itself, he says. So it doesn't mean that I don't think it means that the eye can perceive itself. I think it means the eye can see the medicine. But again, that's just based on what it says here and most other texts that I've read. So he says that, the existence of a self-cognizer is damaged in the same way. You know, this, what they're saying is this rationale, this probands, this reason for asserting the existence of a self-cognizer isn't holding water, because we can't find, you know, that it holds true all the time. Just because you can see something far away doesn't mean that you can see something that's quite near. Okay. Continuing, it says there's an alternative point that he also wants to make here, which I think, again, is very much related to the assertions of Prasangika, of the Madhyamika point of view. Alternatively, not only does such an explanation not prove that the object to be illuminated and the illuminator are one, due to being similarly produced from the single cause of the illuminator. So what he's talking about here is this idea that there could be a consciousness knowing a consciousness. It follows that they cannot be established definitely as being one entity. Why? Because in these examples, when we say that at the time of seeing a vase under the ground, due to applying this eye medicine, then it not only does it not follow, let me try to reword what he said here, because his wording is very, very complex. The vase, one thing, which is under the ground, can't be one with the eye medicine. Anyway, let me try to explain it in other words, because I had it pretty clear in my mind earlier. When we talk about this idea of there being, let's even use their example. So they said, okay, there's this, you're knowing, you're a clairvoyant, and you're knowing somebody's mind at a distance, and you're then capable, according to them, of taking your mind as an object as well, because your mind is quite close. Those speak to the fact that both of those things are quite different substances. You know, so the mind that we are knowing, the mind that we have, are completely different. There's no way that we can kind of know an object without it being something different than the mind that is knowing it. So in a sense, what we're talking about is, from the point of view of what mind only is trying to assert, that there is mind that is inwardly directed knowing mind at the same time, we find in Prasangika a fundamental problem with holding this, with adhering to the fact that mind can take mind as its object, when what it's taking as its object is a subjective experience to begin with. So a subjective experience can't hold another subjective experience simultaneous with it. Within itself, right. So I mean, we can recall our subjective experience, no problem. It's just we don't have the ability to have something that's in the nature of a subjective experience taking something else that's in the nature of a subjective experience when they're both part of the same subjective experience.
Because it's already an experience.
Yeah, and it's already an experience of an object. It already has its own object. How could we have another object of that subjective experience that's the subjective experience itself? So I think there's some real problems with the logistics of this when we start picking apart what is meant by self-cognition. You know, that there's some, the mind is knowing the mind, and the mind that it's knowing is knowing an object. So there's almost an exclusion of there being able to be another subjective experience at that time, because it almost speaks to the fact that they have to be different entities for you to have a subjective experience of an object. Anyway, this is my understanding of this verse. Maybe it's not correct, but all this commentary that he gives here, I think, is a bit hard to follow in terms of when we apply it to the analogy of the eye medicine. I think it's quite clear that we're talking about something that is uniquely, distinctly different than the vase in the ground, you know, the eye medicine and the vase in the ground. But, I mean, Chittamatra isn't even going to adhere to that example for something to prove self-cognizer, so I'm not really sure why that example is being used in this commentary. Any questions on that or comments? I hope that was clear. If it isn't clear, I apologize, but maybe His Holiness's book will give you some insight as well. This is what, verse 24? Okay. There's not really much more in some of these other books. Again, because that explanation is kind of an alternate explanation that's put in there. But it, I think, speaks to the fact that it's really hard to say that we would have these two minds, a self-cognizer and another subjective experience, that are one entity and yet kind of being able to be isolated differently as being in some relationship as subject and object, because you're causing two subjective experiences to exist at the same time, in the same place. Do we ever have two subjective experiences occurring simultaneously? I mean, it's just, there is a subjective experience, period. You know, anyway, I'm pretty sure that that's, again, kind of the right direction in terms of what this alternate explanation is. Let's move on. 720 or 925. This is, again, on page 226. Seeing, hearing, and knowing are not what are refuted here. Here, that which is the cause of suffering, the conception of them as truly existent, is that to be averted. So there's kind of an implicit argument that's set out here now on page 229 of your commentary. A mind-only proponent comes back with one more thing and says, well, you know, we still have a problem, because if you say there's no self-cognizer, then since there's no memory, because we don't, I guess they haven't adhered to any of what Prasangika has said, they haven't, you know, found it to be a convincing argument, since there's no memory, there will be no experiencing of objects, seeing, hearing, and the like. You know, so they're just basically saying, we still have a problem, you haven't really, you know, given us any ground to stand on to refute the existence of a self-cognizer. The middle way proponent comes back and says, you know, conventionalities, everything that, you know, we see by the eye consciousness, that we hear by the ear consciousness, and know by the mental consciousness, and so on, all the various consciousnesses, that's not what is being refuted here. You know, let's get back to kind of what the subject is at hand, is kind of what middle way is saying here. You know, you've been kind of going on about self-cognizers, but when it comes down to it, where this all started, and if we go back to the beginning of this section even, it all starts with a refutation of inherent existence. So he's saying here, this is not what's being refuted here. Why? Because there's no need to refute them. You know, those aren't the cause of suffering. Even foe destroyers who have abandoned, again, a foe destroyer is somebody who's abandoned all the afflictive obstructions through realizing emptiness. They have completely abandoned that. They still have an eye consciousness and an ear consciousness, and they still know objects. They still are involved in reality in that way. That's not the problem. And he says further, they cannot be refuted, because if they must be refuted through scripture and reasoning and refutation, scripture and reasoning are similar to them in being objects to be refuted, since they are also mere appearances. So again, if Chittamatra starts adhering to some sort of, you know, way of refuting the existence of these external things as they have been doing, then, and they say that relies upon scripture. Scripture itself is an external object and would be refuted similarly. Their point is that, you know, let's jump forward to where it says, thus, here that which is the cause of suffering. the conception of these objects as truly existent is that to be averted. Why? Because that itself is the root of cyclic existence. So this is where, again, Prasangika just basically says, you know, all of your arguing about, you know, external objects and then the consciousnesses being validated by self-cognizers and all these other things that Chittamatra is putting out, you're just getting off the point, because when it comes to it, what we're really talking about is removing this fundamental ignorance that is the source of all of our problems. And according to Madhyamaka, that's the conception of true existence. So we're not going to talk about whether we're validating conventional consciousnesses. I mean, conventional consciousnesses isn't the point. We're not getting in trouble with our conventional consciousnesses. Merely knowing blue or, you know, smelling the smell of a rose or anything like that is not getting us in trouble. It's these conceptions that we have that infiltrate and exaggerate these qualities and create all sorts of confusion for us. He goes on then to quote, and I don't know who this Yongzhen Tamche Kempa is. I had the feeling it's Lama Tsongkhapa, but often in the commentary, if it is Lama Tsongkhapa, they'll put that in parentheses. Tamche Kempa, I think, means all omniscient one, all knowing one. Yongzhen, do you know what Yongzhen means, anybody? Yongzhen? I meant to try to look it up, but I'm not really sure. These are like formal titles for people. They're not actual names. This isn't a Lama's name, Lama Yongzhen Tamche Kempa. It's more of an honorific that's given to like the great omniscient one, the all-knowing one type of thing. So it says, therefore, this innate apprehension of I. So what it comes down to is when we're talking about our fundamental ignorance that Madhyamaka is putting out as the main subject of this whole chapter and the main point that they really would prefer mind only to refute with them about, you know, and get some clarity about, is our misapprehension of the I in particular, though of course this is of all phenomena, apprehending the I as being established from the object's own side, from the I's own side. That very object of the mode of apprehension of this mind, the I being established from the object's own side, is the final object of refutation here. So he's just reasserting, you know, what Madhyamaka is saying, what Nagarjuna has said, what the Buddha even said in the final thought of the Buddha, is the problem isn't some misperception of things existing external to the consciousness knowing them, it's mistaking them to have inherent existence, mistaking them to exist from the object's own side, by the object's own power, you know, through the object's own characteristics and so on, all these ways that we have of talking about inherent existence. He goes on then to talk a little bit about these three modes of apprehension that the mind can get involved in. The mind can apprehend any object, the eye is used as the example here, as really established, meaning truly established. This is ignorance. The first one is this fundamental ignorance, thinking that it's established from its own side, inherently existent. The second one, apprehending an I lacking true existence. So we would have to have some wisdom that discerns that that's the way that the I actually exists to be able to do that. You know. And then the third one is apprehension of a mere I without making a distinction through either of the two modes above. So believe it or not, we do have these kind of moments of a lack of any sort of affliction when we are merely nominally involved with objects. You know, we're not adhering to them to have any sort of inherent existence. This probably isn't the general mode of our mind. Our mind is usually quite caught up in things having inherent existence. But it is possible, certainly, to have a conception of them merely existing and as they do conventionally, without being inflated to have true existence or completely negated as having true existence. So in order to get the first, we have to have some ignorance present. In order to get the second, we have to have some wisdom present. The third occurs in those rare times when we're not necessarily influenced by either one of those. We're simply nominally recognizing that things are such. Oftentimes, Genlam Rinpa in his book Realizing Emptiness talks about, for example, when we first encounter objects that we don't know. Oftentimes, you know, when we're quite young, we're learning what things are. Our parents will give us a name or an idea for what something is, and we don't have a strong adherence to it being inherently that. We're simply at the point where it's simply being named or designated. Once we start adhering to it to be that is when we run into problems because the ignorance becomes operative, and then we think things have their own mode of existence that establishes them rather than them merely being designated. Yeah. Were you going to say something, Charmaine? Okay.
I was just having Les Kiddo's television show. It's called, Truth or Dare or something. Like, they would bring out these objects and no one had seen them before, mm-hmm. and they made up, three different stories about what they were used for, and the person had to guess between these two.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to love that show.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an interesting exercise in this novel way of relating objects. Right.
And what's interesting is that they establish the truth of that object at the end of each of those sequences. You know, which one is the real object? You know, it does have this real identity from inside of being that. You know, when all three are imputed on that object and, you know, yeah.
It was funny thing that I was showing, though, because it could have really been any of those. Until the moment that they decided to come this.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was kind of all it read,
Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't it totally weird?
It was a pretty weird show.
Yeah.
I think they ran out of objects after a while. It's a good exercise. It would be interesting to get a copy of that show and watch it and just kind of see how, our minds work in that way. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Yeah, Paul.
So when you're observing this mirror, does that mean that your mind is not in an ignorant state?
It's not in a what state?
That, our minds are always mistaken.
Hmm.
So
no, I mean,
this seems like the point where you're not being mistaken because you are seeing it the way they say things.
What is happening, I think what Lama Zopa is talking about, and I could be wrong, but what I believe he's talking about is that there's no point at which we aren't dealing with mistaken appearance except in direct realization of emptiness. So there is a mistaken appearance still. Things still have an appearance of inherent existence, but it is possible for us to not be adhering to that in the moment, simply out of thinking of something as being merely designated. So our ignorance, again, our ignorance is one form of obstruction. The imprints of that ignorance, that these latencies of ignorance that are the knowledge obstructions, or part of the knowledge obstructions that cause things to have this appearance of inherent existence, is another. Again, my understanding is that it's still possible for us to think of something merely being designated without having any, again, leaning to one side or the other, and yet it might still be infused with that appearance. We just aren't at the point where we're tuning into that appearance or adhering to that appearance yet. And these things can happen quite quickly. I'm not saying that we have huge stretches of our consciousness that are where we're thinking of things as merely designated. Okay, but there are supposedly, again, this is quite common teaching. This was in Illumination of the Thought, Lama Tsongkhapa's commentary on Chandrakirti as well, that these three modes of operation do exist, and we don't say that they're... We wouldn't say that the third one is exclusively the domain of somebody who's had a direct realization of emptiness. But there are moments, albeit maybe very brief moments, where we aren't caught in the game yet. You know, somebody brings in something that, we don't yet have any sort of strong adherence to it being that from its own side yet, but it may have that appearance. We don't even know what the object is yet. We don't even have any way of relating to the object. And then when somebody introduces the object to us and what have you, then we begin to strongly adhere to that. Again, I'm just guessing, again, that's what Rinpoche is talking about, is that we can certainly say that the latencies of ignorance are operative all the time, whether our ignorance is manifest all the time or not. And ideally, this is why, again, we are trying to, even as people who don't have direct realization of emptiness infuse our practice with some recognition of the emptiness of the three spheres, you know, as much as we can, so that we sort of negate some of that conception on a conventional basis, an everyday basis, so that we're not adhering to things in that way and then having afflicted minds towards them on the basis of that adherence. Right.
And sometimes you just stop for a moment. I mean, sometimes it just doesn't seem relevant to do that for some reason. And so you get kind of it's almost like a breath of fresh air sometimes, if you're just not actually in that grasping mind. It can be for a number of reasons, you know, it just occurs. But that tendency to constantly reapply objects and relate to them in a specific way can stop. And then the eye that's involved there is kind of just suspended.
Right.
You know, I don't know if that's what they're talking about, because
I mean, I know Rinpoche does, you know, emphasize the role of the appearance of inherent existence in our misconception a lot. And there's definitely an interrelationship between these two things. Because things appear to be inherently existent, we have a much stronger desire to conceive of them that way. It's just like, you know, in our dream, if our dream objects appeared to be totally dreamlike in the dream, we're convinced that they're quite real. You know, if they were dreamlike and doing things that weren't consistent, like if I've had dreams about people who've deceased, and sometimes in my dreams I've come to the awareness that, oh, this can't possibly be them, they died. And so, you know, when I begin to sort of see it in the moment, then yeah, I can cut through it. But because there's such a strong dreamlike appearance and I'm buying into the reality of dreams so much because of that, they naturally support each other. And in the same way, when we have the appearance of inherent existence, our adherence to that in terms of our conceptual mind, those two very much strengthen each other and very much caught up in each other. So, I mean, I think Rinpoche is basically saying that there's no moment when we kind of don't have that appearance going on, whether we have strong adherence to it or not, or even any adherence to it or not. I think it's possible that we have moments that we don't. Again, that's just sort of those moments in the dream where maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe it's not quite the same thing, because again, in the dream there's almost needs to be some cognition of it, the dreamlike nature of it, to get through it. Here, this isn't what we're talking about here. Again, this is saying an apprehension of a mere eye without distinguishing it as either of the two above, meaning without thinking that it lacks true existence. You know, so that means you're just seeing it as merely labeled. That merely labeled thing, as I understand it, again, is primarily what occurs in our initial sort of designating of things. You know, we have just, again, lots and lots of phenomena that we experience that we don't really ever go through any even conceptual designation of, much less verbal designation of, earlier in our life in particular. And once we begin to do that, designate things as them, shortly after we're adhering to them to be that. It's just like almost instantaneous. And then we're developing afflictions almost instantaneously based on that adherence. You know, that conception paves the way for us to have attachment and aversion and all sorts of things go on. Let's continue on. There's a few more little bits that have to do with this verse. Let's take a break. It's 8:22, otherwise we're going to be taking a break too late. Let's take just like a 5 to 10 minute break, and we'll come back and go through more of this. So we are, again, still on page 229, dealing with this more extended commentary on verse 25. So there is this one little paragraph. This is kind of another weird little thought. Gyaltsep Jay, who was the other disciple, main disciple of Lama Tsongkhapa, has a statement in one of his texts. It says, "The statement, mere appearances to the sense consciousnesses, such as the keeping of silence, are not to be refuted. The apprehension of them as either permanent or impermanent, existent or non-existent, and the like are to be refuted." He's saying that statement is a later saying of Chinese abbots. What he's referring to specifically are what are known as the Hashang. Hashang was a movement within Chinese Buddhism that was really, it's exemplified to some degree in current Zen Buddhism and Chan Buddhism, that one of their main things is stopping conceptualization. And so what he's saying here is that this idea that just stopping conceptualization leads to undermining all of our fundamental ignorance is a statement of these Chinese abbots and not to be taken as the statement of Madhyamaka in any way. So Madhyamaka, while we do say that certainly when we directly realize emptiness, it's a non-conceptual mind, the method of engaging in ceasing conceptuality, which is what, again, my understanding, I may be completely wrong, of a lot of Zen Buddhism is about, is just stopping that thinking mind, stopping that mind that is thinking of things as permanent, impermanent, blah, 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 and abiding in some non-conceptual state, that in and of itself is enough. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there's a strong reliance upon our conceptual mind, as we saw in, remember that, those various minds that we develop in the Satrantika presentation, going from a wrong consciousness through doubt, various levels of doubt, through a correctly assuming consciousness to an inferential cognition to, you know, a direct valid cognition. These ways that we have of kind of working with our conceptual mind to overcome our ignorance, as opposed to negating our conceptual mind, and that in and of itself being an answer to our problems. So that's what that paragraph is about. Then it says, therefore, if the root of cyclic existence is not countered, cyclic existence will not be averted. Since the apprehenders of form, sounds, and so forth as truly existent have been taught to be the root of cyclic existence, it is clearly asserted that hearers and solitary realizers have the realization of the selflessness of phenomena. So this is just reiterating that, and it is only this realization of the emptiness of inherent existence that gets you out of samsara. We're going to see a more extended section on this in verses 40 through 51, where we go into the establishment that this is the wisdom that's necessary for a hearer or a solitary realizer to become liberated. So again, we have these two different paths, the Hinayana path and the Mahayana path. The Hinayana path, as you recall from the study of tenets, in all these other schools, they said that the Hinayanist can realize something very different than the Mahayanist. The Bodhisattva realizes, well, it's sometimes the same, you know, in the lower schools, but even in mind only, the Bodhisattva might realize this emptiness of external object being a different substance and the consciousness knowing it. But the Hinayanist, to become liberated, only needs to realize what? The selflessness of persons, which is the lack of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. So this is going to be refuted in Prasangika as well. They say, whether you're a Hinayanist, a Mahayanist, both, all three vehicles, the two vehicles of the lower and the one of the higher, have to realize the emptiness of inherent existence to attain their respective goals, whether it be just individual liberation or complete enlightenment. So there's absolutely no difference in that either. So this is just kind of also reiterating, you know, some of these other views that were held at the time, you know, whether stopping conceptuality or recognizing some other form of selflessness or whatever, that these are in and of themselves the answer to being free of our suffering and attaining enlightenment.
Stopping conceptuality makes you enlightened. That's what I get to when I'm tired. I mean, I just go numb. I'm sure not enlightened when I'm interested. I mean, I just get to where it's to have one more thought makes no sense, you know, and I just go, oh.
Well, that's why I think, you know, again, there's discerning what are the conceptions to be stopped and what are the conceptions that help us to stop those conceptions. But even have to the even to have the conception that you're not going to have conceptions is a conception.
That's right.
You know, this was one of the ways that they defeated them, is kind of like saying, but isn't your not wanting to have conceptions a conception? You know? Debating them. So they have to deal with the consequences of what they're holding to. So, okay, let's go on to verse 26. Let's read here, again, page 226. Verse 26, just the first two lines. Illusions are not other than the mind, yet they are also not considered to be other. This is a really, really weird two lines. And when you look at His Holiness's book, you actually see a very different translation of these two lines. And I'm frankly a little confused because the commentary seems to support the way that it's worded in the handout that I gave you. Whereas if we go to His Holiness's, the first two lines of this are, illusions are not other than the mind, you say, and yet you also claim that they are not the same. That makes a little more sense to me rather than here where it says, illusions are not other than the mind, yet they are not also considered to be other.
Sounds like
it sounds like he's saying the same thing twice. And if you go to the commentary on page 230 at the top, this mind-only proponent is saying, since there are no external objects, illusions, that is, forms and so forth, are not other substance than the mind. So he's saying, because this is the illusion that objects are external to the mind, they are not an other substance to the mind. In other words, they are the same substance as the mind. Yet, since previously there was the criticism, by what is it seen, these two, which in parentheses here, this is added by the people doing the translation, mind and forms and so forth, are also not considered to be other. We just said that they were not considered to be other, that they were the same. So I think there is some problems in the translation. Again, my understanding, I'm going to base it on what His Holiness says, which is basically that Chittamatra's got this strange sort of thing that they're holding where they're saying that, yeah, this is an external object that's not other than the mind, yet at the same time, we wouldn't really equate it with the mind. We're not saying that this is mind. Chittamatra doesn't go that far. When they say mind only, they're not saying that this is actually mind. It's arising from the same seed within our consciousness that gives rise to these two events, an objective experience, a subjective experience, but they're both arising from the same seed, and there's an illusion going on and thinking that it's distinct and separate and apart from the mind. But it's hard to explain it because they're not saying that they're other than each other and they're not saying that they're the same. So what are they saying? But anyway, this is kind of what is going on here is that Chittamatra is setting out their position. Middle way proponent, let's go ahead and read the next two lines of 26 and then the first two lines of 27. If they are things, how could they not be other? Stating they are not other, they would not exist as things. Just as illusions are not truly existent, but are objects of view, likewise, the consciousnesses are viewers. So middle way starts off by saying, okay, once again, we go back and we say, you know, either you got to admit it's one way or the other, Chittamatra. You know, if you're saying they're not other and they're not the same, well, at some point, there's no other option. So you're either going to say that they are other or that they are the same, and let's look at the consequences of that. If forms and so forth are truly existent, you know, meaning they exist in truth in the way that they appear, then they must be true in that way, just the way they appear. In that case, since they appear as external objects, they must be established as external objects. You know, so you can't... And they're even making a point here about Chittamatra holding objects to be truly existent at the same time that they don't exist externally. This is a real problem, because truly existent means existing in truth as the way it appears. So there's a problem right from the beginning with the mind-only view from what middle way's perspective. Now, on the other hand, if, you know, and then it says, then they must be established as external objects. But if they are external things, how could they not be other substance than the mind? Meaning if they are as Chittamatra is holding them to be, merely illusory external things, how could they not be some other substance than the mind? So it's like saying, you know, okay, you said that they weren't other than the mind, but you're also saying they're not the same as the mind. So if you actually hold that this is an illusion and that this is arising from the mind, then it's got to be the mind. It's got to be the same substance as the mind. It's got to be the same entity as the mind.
Middle way is modifying right. your mind somewhat differently.
I mean, there is that that
form of yeah. form of experiential stuff that can just really fully be just temporary experiential.
Right.
Stuff.
I mean, I hear what you're saying. I think it's just still really hard for them when they say this, that their experiential aspects or whatever we want to call them, but what does that mean? How do they really exist? You know, do they exist external? Do they exist as mine? Which one are they, or are they neither? If they're neither, then what are they? I think that there's just really, it's really hard to establish how things exist in that framework. Yeah. Yeah. Again, and it's one of the most tricky things about getting the mind-only view is that the mind-only view is near, I think, all the time pretty much explained by a prasangika, and never explained by a mind-only proponent, even though this says mind-only proponent. Trust me, these are words being put in a mind-only proponent's mouth by prasangika, and so. It's really hard to say if we had a mind-only person here, you know, sitting here, and they had some realization of this or some experience with it, whether what they had to say about it would be in line with what these assertions are, or would they have some other way of explaining it that, yeah, gets to how they're really seeing it.
There's something in Nepal, in
I think he's just another Tibetan point of view. I don't think he's giving a mind-only point of view. I don't think so. I think it's a Mipham. I think was Nyingma. I think I could be wrong. You're talking about there's a commentary that's it's a, yeah yeah. I'm pretty sure that's a Nyingma commentary. Again, this book here that I have, this first part is also a Nyingma commentary. And they're going to have a slightly different way, that and the Kagyu school, I think both of them, of talking about emptiness. Even though they call themselves Prasangika Madhyamika, they're going to still give it a slightly different flavor. I will go on to kind of complete this paragraph. This is where it gets even a little bit more confusing. They say it follows that they are other substance than the mind. I mean, well, I guess this is Prasangika just basically saying that from our point of view, the second one simply doesn't hold that they can be the same. So it follows that they've got to be an other substance than the mind. If, you know, according to what we say, which is objects exist external to the mind, then they've got to be an other substance. They're different than the mind. Stating they are not other substance, it follows that they would not exist as truly existent things. So if they do hold, if mind only would say, well, no, they are not an other substance to the mind, well then, you know, holding them to be truly existent at that time couldn't possibly be correct, because true existence implies, again, that they exist the way they appear. They exist, they appear as external, they don't exist as external, so how could they be truly existent if they're not other than the mind, which is what Chittamatra holds. Asserting appearances is false, they are not other than it. They're the same as mind then. Anyway, this is just kind of pointing to the contradictory things that we see in Chittamatra. If they say that they're different than the mind, they can't hold them to be truly existent. It's impossible. If they adhere to them as being the same as the mind, then there's consequences of that. If they say that it's neither of these, then what is it? What is going on? And I don't think that, again, there's a satisfactory explanation of what Chittamatra really holds in terms of that. This idea of them being expressions of the mind or something is kind of thrown out there, but I don't think it holds any water. This next paragraph is basically... let me go back to my other notes here. This is the first two lines, then, of 27 that we just read. This is really setting out the point of view of middle way. So it says, just as illusions, forms, and so forth, which appear as objects, are not truly existent, but yet are objects of observation that are objects of view of the mind. So this is what middle way holds. Sorry. Madhyamika says, these external objects, you know, mala and orchid and table and all these other things, they appear as objects, no problem. They're not truly existent, and yet they are objects of observation of a mind. They're different than the mind. You know, this is not arising from the same substance as the mind. This is not mind. You know, we don't have a problem, the same problem that Chittamatra does in positing how these things exist. Likewise, the six consciousnesses are similar in not being truly existent, although they are viewers, they're object possessors. So there's equal status of all these things, whether we're talking about external objects or subjects, no problem. They all exist in the same way. They all lack inherent existence, true existence. Hence, the middle way proponents do not incur the previously stated fault, which, you know, in verse 9:15, there was this fault that was set out. It says, even if a mistaken consciousness does not exist, kind of like saying, well, if you know, because it doesn't inherently exist, it doesn't exist. So if your mind doesn't inherently exist, it can't possibly exist. This is what Chittamatra would say. According to what we're saying, there's not that problem. We can hold lack of inherent existence and existence simultaneously. Not a problem. So if you, the mind-only proponents, were to also rely on that mode, it would be wonderful. So it's kind of like, you know, in the end sort of telling them, well, you know, you've got to apply the same logic and, you know, realize it in the same way and you'll be just fine. You know, you won't have any problems.
As Shantideva was, in this part of the text, he was probably already off the cushions and floating somewhere.
No, actually, I think he doesn't start floating until... No, it's chapter 9. It's a point in chapter 9 a bit later, though. I think it's like 1:34 or something. I have it written down where he starts floating, so we can, like, you know, maybe our text will start floating or something. Let's read the last two and of 27 and, just the last two of 27. Cyclic existence has its support things. Other than that, it would be like space. So there's an argument being put forth by mind only saying, well, you know, we still can't buy your saying things lack inherent existence. The implication of things lacking inherent existence is that they don't have a findable support that is them. So again, when we go through in the later verses of this chapter, all these various reasonings, the reasoning that discerns the emptiness of mala goes looking for mala, this inherently existent mala, mala existing from its own side, as needing to exist then somewhere out here on this support, this basis of mala. You know, and so mind only basically holds that all these falsities and imputed existence, anything that they hold to, you know, exist, such as cyclic existence and the like, all have as their support, you know, or as their basis, some truly existent thing. Otherwise, they couldn't be what they are. You know, they say there's got to be some mala-ness out here, or it couldn't possibly be mala. Otherwise, you know, we could say this is mala, and this is mala, and this is mala, because, you know, there's got to be some findable mala-ness that makes it mala. For example, because all mistakes have some truly existent basis, they basically say that even though there's an error going on, there's something that is truly existing, that is inherently existing, that's underneath that error. So yeah, I'm thinking that this exists external to the mind and it doesn't, but there's still its own true nature that makes me see it as, you know, thermal cup, that even though I have the illusion that thermal cup exists external to the mind. They say it's for an example, even though a log may be mistaken for a human being, this might be more like maybe some logs could be mistaken, but they say even like, you know, a part of a tree, like a tree stump or something on the horizon at dusk could be mistaken for a person, you know, something that appears to have arms or something, and you might think for a minute that it's a person, and then when you realize that it's not moving and, you know, you even get a little bit closer to it or take out your binoculars or whatever, you see that it's just a log. But even though that log may be mistaken as a human being, the log is established as true. So they use this as an analogy to say, kind of in the same way that, you know, I think that this is external to the mind, there's still some trueness to it in spite of it not existing in that way. that kind of still say that there's something there. This is, again, this fundamental thing where we use the analogy of a log. You know, when you're floating out in the middle of the lake, you keep holding on to the log of inherent existence, this thing that keeps you afloat, because you think that without it, it all falls apart. Only with it does it all stay together. I mean, only with the emptiness of it does it all stay together, is what I was saying. So again, this fundamental problem that we have of letting go of inherent existence is exemplified here. So similarly, if cyclic existence does not depend on anything other than depending on the basis of truth, it would lack things like space. I mean, it would, just like space has no real defining characteristics per se, it's just space. In the same way, you know, anything would be anything. You wouldn't have anything with any real defining characteristics. Okay, middle way proponent. Let's read verse 28. And let's go ahead and read 28 and 29, I think. Let's see. Yeah, let's just read 28 and 29, and we'll go through all this. If non-things depended on things, then how can they have functions? Your mind would be alone without companions. If the mind were free from apprehendeds, at that time all would be tathagatas. If so, what excellence would there be in considering mere mind? So these are kind of pointing out, I was saying earlier, and when Rowena made her comment, that there's kind of like all these consequences that ensue when you adhere to inherent existence. So the first two lines there of 28, if non-things depended on things, then how can they have functions? First there's this weird little bit that says that the explanation is taught in Compendium of Training, Siksa Samuchaya, which is really the only other existing text of Shantideva that we have now, but it doesn't go on to say whether this explanation is consistent with that, but my teacher didn't give any additional commentary, so I really can't say much more about that. But there where it says, middle way proponent, if falsities, non-things such as cyclic existence, depend on things that are truly existent, mistaken bases, this is what mind only is saying, something that is an illusion or a non-thing, doesn't exist that way, depends upon something that does exist in truth, that isn't a falsity. How will they have functions of producing effects such as bondage and freedom? This is one of the fundamental things about adhering to kind of inherent existence, is that if something inherently exists, it cannot function. It cannot possibly do anything, because inherent existence flies in the face of functionality, flies in the face of impermanence, flies in the face of so many things that when we examine in conventional existence, we find that those are there. Things do change. Things do function. Let's continue with this paragraph. It says, it follows that they will not, because the bases that are dependent upon truly existent things do not exist. The reason is taught in, again, the Siksa Samuchaya. By way of your system, mind-only proponents, so this is the next two lines, is kind of like saying, you know, if we really adhere to your tenets, mind-only, if we kind of go along with what you say for the time being, this is some kind of interesting logic. We'll see if we can follow all of this. It follows, one, that, you know, or this is the main consequence, is that mind would be alone, self-cognizing and self-illuminating without companions, such as mistaking the apprehendeds and apprehenders as dual. How does he arrive at this conclusion? He says, one, since you assert that this appearance of the object and the object possessor as being far away and cut off, this is the ignorance that we have in mind-only. Mind-only says that our fundamental ignorance that we need to get rid of to become a Buddha is this view that things are distant and cut off from the mind that perceives them. So it says, if this is, you know, is that's not established as it appears, external objects do not exist. Makes sense so far. And since the appearances of forms and so forth, being consciousnesses has been refuted above. So mind only has basically said that they are not mind. Okay. So one, they're not external objects. Two, they're not mind. Okay. They are not consciousnesses. In this case, with both of those things, since they would be other objects unrelated to consciousness, although the appearance of forms and so forth would be corrupted, meaning they're together with some form of ignorance, the consciousness itself, the substance of consciousness, would be uncorrupted. It's kind of like, you know, again, this might be the hardest part to get, is where they're making this jump to this statement, kind of saying, if that's so, if they're not external objects, they're not the same as consciousness, the only way that we can logically see to say that they exist is as something unrelated to consciousness. Maybe not external, but it's got to be definitely unrelated if it's not the same. Although there is some sort of corruption of that appearance of them as being external, the mind in and of itself is without that. Because consciousnesses are existing as something else, unrelated. I'm sorry, external objects are existing as something else unrelated to consciousness. If you assert this, then it follows that the mind would be free from the appearances of dual apprehendents and apprehenders, and at that time all sentient beings would be enlightened. I mean, they'd be tathagatas, because you wouldn't have that ignorance operative at all. You wouldn't have any sort of illusion of going on of duality of subject and object. They would all be freed effortlessly, because all sentient beings would be free from the appearances of dual apprehendents and apprehenders. You know, the duality of subject and object being distinct and cut off. Again, it's kind of a hard one to follow. I can't say I have it completely, but I was going to read from maybe... Does anyone else have any comments or questions on that? Are we reaching saturation point? Pretty close, yeah. Okay. Well, we only have like just a tiny little bit to finish, and so we'll do that. But I just want to see if I can read something here that's going to maybe give you a little bit more insight. Okay. Maybe we'll start there. Sometimes these books are really helpful. Sometimes you look at them and you kind of go... Okay. So now the last bit of 29, where it says there, if so, what excellence would there be in considering mere mind? So here the commentary says, if it's asserted so, you know, as we've just explained, then what excellence or what purpose would there be in considering, you know, or determining mere mind, in which apprehendeds and apprehenders are empty of being different substances, which is what Chittamatra holds, you know, for the sake of obtaining omniscience. There's no purpose to that at all. Again, they're following out their logic and saying, you know, based on the way that you're talking about these external objects and how they exist, how consciousness exists, what illusion is going on, we find the consequence that based on how you're doing that and how we would have to assert external objects because they're not external and they're not consciousness, that there's no real... illusion going on in the end, that this idea of there being a misapprehension of duality of subject and object isn't really a reality. Therefore, there's no point in realizing it. There's no point in meditating on it. There's no point in that being the means to obtain omniscience. And they just kind of, in the end, refuting that there's any ground for this Chittamatra point of view, and therefore there's no ground in realizing the emptiness that Chittamatra sets up. So I'd encourage you to maybe, you know, take a look at the verses in His Holiness's text, and if you have other texts to refer to. And when we get back together next time, we'll kind of go through that again. And that concludes the section on mind only. So just as a real quick preview where we're going next time then, we'll just sort of wrap up this mind only section. See if there's any questions based on your reading about that. And then if you can... read through this next section if you haven't already, on verses 30 through 39. This is somebody basically saying that in spite of what we've just said, there still is no need to realize emptiness that middle way holds or propounds, and there's also no effectiveness to that realization. So we're going to get into kind of Shantideva's refutation that everything that he's saying here doesn't serve a purpose, because we've just said that realizing mind only doesn't serve a purpose, their view of emptiness. So somebody's going to come back and say, well, but you haven't shown us yet that there's a purpose in what you're holding emptiness to be and our realization of that. So this, you know, this, these sections actually do really make a lot of sense in terms of how they flow one into the other, because of the various assertions that we get to at the end of each of them, they naturally lead into some other arguments or positions that would come up on the basis of that. So it's interesting that Shantideva does set out an awful lot of explanation, sort of verifying that this is the right view and refuting these other views before he even really goes into how you develop this correct view of emptiness. You know, you might think you'd do the opposite direction. First you'd kind of learn how to realize emptiness and then do all of that, but for whatever reason he felt that it was necessary to do a lot of refutation of other points of view and really establishing the need for realizing emptiness before he even went into the reasonings. So, we'll get together again next time and continue. No questions? Yeah, we usually don't do it on Wednesday night just because of time. But we'll, maybe we can think about her at the end. And this is Jane Jasper's mother. Those of you who know Jane from Las Vegas, who she used to come on Sunday sometimes. She's speaking of Zen, primarily a Zen student, but she found coming here quite useful for her study and practice. So her mother's quite ill in Southern California, I think. Yeah, I've got the email here as well if anybody wants to read it, and Rowena has it. So let's turn the books open to 235. And we're just going to read through these first two verses. We won't do them in Tibetan tonight. And again, thinking that we're strongly dedicating all these merits for that motivation that we had at the beginning to become enlightened, to lead all beings to that same state. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Turn forward to 246. And we'll recite these verses from Shantideva. So at this point, maybe we can think about those who we'd like to dedicate for specifically. And you don't need to say their names, but definitely we're thinking of, you know, Terry Jasper, Jane's mother. Thinking of all those beings in our lives who are experiencing obstacles or illness. Those who have died recently, or even those who are caring for those who are ill or dying. So thinking about all these beings and the various challenges that they're facing, and making strong prayers that all the merit that we've created tonight becomes the cause for them to find perfect conditions in this life and future lives, to have all of their problems and difficulties removed as quickly as possible. And we can think it goes even beyond just the merits we create tonight, but, you know, all of our merits and all the merits of all beings who commit virtuous actions be dedicated for these causes. We can recite the prayer together. May all beings everywhere plagued by sufferings of body and mind obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never appear again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. You can turn back to 244. And, yeah, I don't think we passed these out. Maybe we could... Ajna, could you grab, or Charmaine, the prayer for His Holiness? And those who don't have a copy. What we're going to do is recite the long life prayer for His Holiness, and then we're going to recite this prayer that spontaneously fulfills all wishes that Rinpoche translated recently for His Holiness, particularly because this year is a very difficult one for His Holiness. And then we'll recite the long life prayer for Lama Zopa Rinpoche. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who makes extremely clear the path that is unification of emptiness and compassion, to the lotus holder Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjuna's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers, honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And lastly, we can dedicate for peace, peace in the hearts and minds of each and every being throughout all realms. Thank you all very much. As I stumble through these verses, this commentary sometimes is more difficult than, yeah. I don't know.